What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for July 25th, 2017. This is Peter Ceretta. On today's show, we will be doing a lot of news because Comic-Con happened this past week, and there's a lot of leftovers, and there's just a lot of news happening. So we have no time for a water cooler, mailbag, or feature today. In the news, we'll be talking about Avengers. We'll be talking about Thor. We'll be talking about Captain Marvel, Justice League reshoots, James Bond, and Stranger Things 2. So there's just so much to talk about. And we're going to have both Ben Pearson and Huaichan Bui on. Right now I have Ben. How's it going, Ben?
Hey, what's up?
First, I want to thank you for keeping the ship afloat as we were all in San Diego, you know, not sleeping, waiting in lines, and trying to cover a ton of stuff that just got put online after we saw it. So
yeah, absolutely. You guys, killed it. You did a great job. So,
and I want to apologize to the audience in advance for the barrage of superhero news that we are about to dump on you. I know that not everybody loves the superhero beat, but that just happens to be, you know, everybody was at Comic-Con and everybody was doing interviews. So we just have a lot of it. But yeah, Before we get into superheroes, let's get into James Bond, because this story just broke that a new James Bond movie was announced. You wrote the article for SlashFilm.com. What do we know?
So we know very little, actually. The James Bond official Twitter account just tweeted, "James Bond will return to U.S. cinemas on November 8th, 2019, with a traditional earlier release in the U.K. and the rest of the world." That's it. That's all we know. So James Bond is coming back on November 8th, 2019. That's really all. We're not sure if Daniel Craig...
Do we even know if Sony is distributing this film?
No, we don't, actually, because Sony's distribution deal with MGM and Eon Productions lapsed after Spectre, which was the last Bond movie that came out in 2015. So there has been, as recently as this past April, a five-studio battle for the rights to distribute the next Bond movie, and we're not sure who has emerged victorious from that yet, if anyone. I think Hollywood Reporter said that I believe Sony and Warner Brothers are the two candidates who are still sort of in the fight. So I don't know if the winner hasn't been announced yet, or if the winner hasn't been determined yet.
Well, if Warner Brothers gets this deal, you know there's a certain director that has a deal at Warner Brothers.
Yes, that would be Christopher Nolan.
Yes. So what's the chances of Christopher Nolan directing this James Bond movie?
It's so unclear based on just a release date that we have. But Nolan relatively recently said he's been talking about making a Bond movie or wanting to make a Bond movie for, I think, at least 7 years, maybe longer than that. So he's had actual conversations with Michael G. Wilson and Barbara Broccoli, who are the producers of the Bond franchise. He's met with them multiple times over the years and talked about the potential of directing a Bond movie. I think his most recent comments during the Dunkirk press tour, he was saying that he would love to make a Bond movie, but he would only come on board if the franchise, quote, needs reinvention. So to me, that means he would not come back, or he would not direct a new Bond movie if Daniel Craig were to come back to reprise that role, because that seems like whatever Bond 25 is going to be, if Craig is involved, it's going to be sort of his send-off, and that doesn't exactly sound like a reinvention. If he doesn't come back, I feel like the odds are much higher that Nolan might be brought on, especially since he doesn't have an officially announced follow-up movie to Dunkirk yet. So it would be interesting to see if that happens. I think a more likely choice is probably Patrick McGowan. McGuigan. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce that. It's Scottish last name, so I know the pronunciations get a little strange there. But he directed Lucky Number 11. He's directed a bunch of episodes of Sherlock, and he actually was rumored to be the director of this new Bond movie, Bond 25, back in May. So, you know, that hasn't been officially confirmed yet, but those are the possibilities that are sort of floating out there right now.
Yeah, I like Patrick's style. I would love to see a Christopher Nolan Bond movie. He's already been borrowing a lot from Bond in all of his movies. If you look at Dark Knight Rises, that opening plane sequence was definitely mm-hmm. inspired by a James Bond movie. I've already theorized on this podcast, I'd like to see Christopher Nolan direct a James Bond that takes place, you know, a period setting of the 1960s.
Yeah, man, that would be so awesome.
Yeah. So we really don't know anything. We know a release date, and yep. even then, we don't even know the UK release date.
That's true.
So let's move on to some stuff we do know about, and that includes Justice League.
Yes.
We've heard that Joss Whedon, obviously, is taking over this film from Zack Snyder, who had some tragedy in his life and had to step down. We assume that there was going to be some extensive reshoots, and now that has been confirmed. What do we know?
Yeah, so at Comic-Con, Ray Fisher, who plays Cyborg in Justice League, basically said that the movie's reshoots were, quote, brief, if anything. But now a new report from Variety says that it sort of confirms what you'd been hearing and what some of us had been hearing, that these reshoots are a pretty big deal. The studio is spending $25 million on them, and the reshoots themselves have lasted roughly 2 months at this point, which has proven to be problematic for a lot of the in-demand actors that this movie has. Hilariously, my favorite part of this entire story is that Henry Cavill, who obviously plays Superman, is also starring in Mission Impossible 6 over at Paramount, and he grew a mustache to play that character, and Paramount refuses to allow him to shave that off because he has to go back and forth between movies. So he's going, you know, he's filming Mission Impossible, he's jumping back over to Warner Brothers to do some Superman stuff. Paramount's like, hell no, you can't shave that mustache. So now they're going to have to digitally remove Henry Cavill's mustache from the Justice League pickups. So that is the idea, that somebody's just going to have to sit in front of a computer and like scrape off Henry Cavill's upper lip is just amusing to no end.
That is hilarious. That's not the first time a superhero has grown facial hair in reshoots, you know, that caused problems. And I'm speaking of, I mean, this is a much smaller scale, but Joss Whedon, again, had an idea of an end credit scene for Avengers and filmed it after the junket, the day after the junket, of them in the shawarma scene. And Chris Evans had a beard, I believe. So when you see him sitting there at the table, he has his like hand over his face, and it's basically because he's hiding the facial hair.
Wow.
But that way you could hide it that way. In this film, they're doing 2 months of reshoots. I'm not sure how much Superman is in that movie, but you can't hide that with a hand. You have to. That's funny. But it's also funny, you know, Ray Fisher saying that the reshoots were brief, if anything, right next to Ben Affleck saying that, you know, he's going to be in the Batman, which I still don't believe.
Yeah, we'll see about that. Yeah, I think the only other big piece that's worth talking about with the Justice League thing is that there's been some discussion about whether or not Joss Whedon is going to receive directing credit for the movie, because he came on, and by the time the movie is released, he will have been working on Justice League for the past 6 months. Yeah. And
yeah, there aren't a lot of examples of this happening in previously, yeah. Really.
Yeah. So it's tough. I was sort of, you can read it on slashfilm.com. I wrote up a article that sort of runs through the Directors Guild of America and the way that they, determine credit and, how that, you know, historically they've sort of, allowed people to share directing credit if there's, quote, a bona fide team involved. I'm not sure if they are going to, I mean, they aren't going to look at Snyder and Whedon as a team, but yeah. Because they didn't make the movie together. But I wonder how much this decision is going to be, you know, set a precedent for what's going on with Ron Howard and the Lord and Miller situation over at Lucasfilm. So, you know, there's Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, even in cases where there were a bona fide team, like with John Wick, you know, the DGA has prevented them from sharing credit. Like, you know, Rodriguez and Frank Miller mm-hmm. with yep. Sin City. Usually you have to be related. You have to be brothers or sisters, unless, you know, you were working together before you entered right. the DGA. I mean, you have it all in your article here, but I would think that someone's going to have to get a co-director credit, and someone's going to have to get the director credit.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's Variety's report says that they have a source that says that Whedon will not be receiving a directing credit, but I think it's sort of too early to determine that. I'm not sure who their source is, where that's coming from, unless that source is from the DGA. I don't really know if we can. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they believe it and they'll stand by that, but I'm just, I don't know. It remains to be seen.
And the other interesting thing about this is, even if all parties agree upon something, it's still DGA that decides this.
Right.
Yes. To protect, I mean, it's to protect the directors, because obviously, you know, a director could be forced to sign onto a movie, you know, in circumstances that are not good.
Right.
So this is all to protect the director, so we might not know what the credits are until, you know, the junket mm-hmm. before the movie's released.
Yep.
Also in the news, Taika Waititi was at Comic-Con and he did some press. He talked to MTV News and he was talking about the comedy in Thor Ragnarok, and he let it slip that probably 80% of the film was improvised. What does that mean? Because I don't think they're making up big action sequences on
right.
set.
Right, yeah. So his quote is, "I would say we improvised probably 80% of the film, or ad-libbed and threw in stuff. My style of working is I'll often be behind the camera or right next to the camera yelling words at people like, say this, say this, say it this way. I'll straight up give Anthony Hopkins a line reading, I don't care," which I love that last part. The idea of, you know, he just doesn't give a crap at all and will just, you know, he knows what he wants and he'll yeah. make sure he gets it. So what I think this really means is, you know, the concept of alts, right? You've heard this probably in reference to Judd Apatow movies, Hollywood comedies. They'll shoot a sequence or a scene as it is on the page. And then if they have extra time built in, if they have good producers who have sort of understand the way that the directors work, there will be some extra time for them to sort of play around with it and maybe ad-lib and sort of, you know, tweak what's on the page in order to find something that maybe is a little bit more natural, maybe fits better with the characters, whatever. I think that's probably what's going on here. I think what Waititi is actually saying is, you know, we had a structure of this movie. We had all of the main plot beats laid out. And then what has ended up in the cut that he has right now, which we still don't know if that's the final cut or not. The movie doesn't come out until November, so I'm sure he's still going to be working on it for a little bit. But what is in that cut right now is that 80% of the dialogue is not the first take. You know, it's one of the things that they did to sort of tweak it and improve it there on the day.
Yeah.
So I don't think anybody should freak out like, wow, this is insane. They're, you know, improvising 80% of a massive, you know, multi-$100 million blockbuster movie. I think it's more representative of the way that Waititi has, you know, he comes from a comedic background of small, you know, really funny movies. And I think he's just, it's a good representation of him translating that style to a huge production like a Marvel movie.
Although saying that, having seen some footage at Comic-Con this past weekend, they showed this scene between Thor and Jeff Goldblum's character, and it was unlike anything I've seen in any Marvel movie. Not that it looked different than any Marvel movie. I mean, it did look crazy, but the interactions and the comic timing, and I mean, it might be that it was just Goldblum being Goldblum. But the it felt like you could feel some energy that wasn't, you know, that it wasn't part of a script. And I think that's probably why MTV asked about this. Obviously,
and
there
also,
was
like,
stuff in the news recently with Phil Lord and Chris Miller, you know, leaving Han Solo or being fired from Han Solo because of maybe clashes in style. Maybe they didn't know how to make a blockbuster. Who knows? It's interesting that, you know, one side of the Disney kingdom.
Right.
Yeah,
within the same umbrella. Yeah, that is that's something that I found fascinating too. It's like Kathleen Kennedy and the Star Wars people are seemingly a little bit more rigid about how they run their side of the ship over there. But
It's also the difference of, like, you know, this is under Disney, the, you know, third or fourth Star Wars movie coming out, and, you know, that has a distinctive tone and whatever. At this point, Marvel's, you know, what, 20 films in.
Right.
So they're trying interesting things. If this was Thor, if this was the first Thor movie, it would have been insane. Like, this
is, it's a little bit apples and oranges with the comparison, but you know, worth bringing up because of the way that that was such a centerpiece in all the stories coming out around the way that Lord and Miller were handling their set. So,
And we also learned someone's joining the cast.
Yes, that would be character actor Clancy Brown, who many people will probably recognize as, I think he plays Captain Hadley in The Shawshank Redemption. He has done a ton of voiceover work. He is actually providing the voice for a character called Surtur, which is a fiery demon that appears at the very end of the Thor Ragnarok trailer that came online this past weekend. Looks sort of like the Balrog from Lord of the Rings. It's this huge creature that's apparently like 1,000 feet tall, and Hulk in the final shot of the trailer sort of jumps and, you know, looks like he's about to punch this demon creature in the face. So Clancy Brown, who has this really great deep baritone voice, is apparently coming on and doing the voice of Surtur, and Taika Waititi is doing the motion capture work for that character's body. And we know that he's already doing motion capture work for the character of Korg. But it looks like he's kept himself busy behind the camera as well as in front of it for this film.
It's amazing how much of Waititi's style and humor is coming through in this movie. You see other directors come on board Marvel movies, and I'm not saying, you know, Russo Brothers or Whedon, you know, but others, and it seems like they're doing Marvel style. And this definitely seems like it's a Taika Waititi movie.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
Moving on slashfilm.com, I did a trailer breakdown for that new Stranger Things 2 trailer, which is, by the way, it's interesting that they're calling it Stranger Things 2, not Stranger Things Season 2, but it's like a sequel to a movie.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of in line with what the Duffer Brothers have said, that they, you know, that's the way that they approached this story, is like, you know, it's become a cliche really of like, oh, it's one long movie. But I think they considered the first season of Stranger Things to be a movie, and then season two is another movie that has like a whole different set of influences and references and stuff like that. So it sort of makes sense, even though it is a little strange for a TV show to be referring to itself as a sequel. But
I like it. It's just confusing on how do we frame it on the site.
Yeah, how do we talk about it?
Because are people going to search for Stranger Things Season 2? Or are they going to search for Stranger Things 2? But anyways, this trailer is amazing. I'm sure you saw it. What did you think of the trailer?
Yeah, I loved it. I think it's my favorite thing that I've seen out of Comic-Con in general. I love the first season of Stranger Things. So the idea of these kids you know, suiting up as the Ghostbusters and and getting back into some upside down action is was really great to me. And your breakdown like really covers, I think, everything that you could possibly need to know about about what this trailer you know, has to offer.
Well, that's the great thing I love about us doing trailer breakdowns is it's us investigating, like, you know, and speculating upon stuff that we possibly don't know, some things we do know.
Yeah.
It's like searching the frame and seeing, oh, what's that in the corner? What could that mean?
Yeah.
And you can read the whole thing on slashfilm.com, and there's a lot of good info there that maybe even after you've seen the show, you probably wouldn't recognize. But one thing I wanted to bring up on here is the video game that they're playing at the arcade, which is called Dragon's Lair. It's a 1983 Starcom video game. I've never played it, although I've seen it. I don't know where I've seen it, but it's definitely something I've seen. The style's definitely recognizable because it's from ex-Disney animator Don Bluth studio. And it was one of the first video games that was on Laserdisc, and they were using Laserdisc storage to overcome limitations of traditional video games of that era. I've never played it, but I've heard that, like, basically it's, like, animated, and you have to – it's all about timing, like hitting mm-hmm. things at certain times. And the reason why I wanted to bring up this video game is in the first season of Stranger Things, they had a Dungeons & Dragons game that was – hugely influential on that season. It was, you know, it was a metaphor for a lot of things. It introduced the idea of the Demogorgon. How do you even pronounce that? Demigod?
I think it's Demogorgon.
Demogorgon.
Yeah,
I always mess it up. and also, you know, some people might not notice this, but it foreshadows some stuff. Will uses a fireball against the Demogorgon, which foreshadows Nancy, Jonathan, and Steve setting the monster on fire in chapter 8. So, you know, could Dragon's Lair potentially provide clues to this upcoming season? And the story of the game, Dragon's Lair, is it's about a knight named Dirk the Daring who is attempting to rescue a Princess Daphne from the evil dragon Singe, who has locked the princess in the foul wizard Mordok's castle. Okay?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if what we're seeing on screen has anything to do with anything, but just the plot of the game seems very likely that has something to do with the show because, you know, could Princess Daphne be 11 trapped in the upside down? Who's the dragon? Is it this, like, new, huge, like, Lovecraftian monster? Mm-hmm. What do you think we could read from this?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect reading. I think, like you said, I mean, there's so much in the Dungeons & Dragons game. There's so many parallels there between what happens in that first episode and then what happens later in that season that I think it would be a mistake to overlook Dragon's Lair as just, you know, a kitschy sort of 80s throwback. I think they really probably chose that game on purpose and you know, incorporated it thematically with what they're trying to do in Stranger Things 2. So I think the idea of Eleven being the princess is really great. I am also hoping that she sort of subverts the traditional princess trope, and it looks like she is not, you know, from what we see in the trailer, she sort of finds her own way out of the upside down instead of being rescued. So, you know, that's always a good thing. I'm not sure what other parallels we can draw from it. Maybe if this is something that shows up in the first episode and we actually see more of the gameplay and are able to, you know, sort of track what those characters do, then maybe we can keep that stuff in mind.
In the gameplay that we see in the trailer, the knight tries to, I think, get a sword, and it's basically the dragon shows up and breathes fire on him and basically kills him. You know, he is incinerated. I'm not sure if that has anything to do with anything.
Will one of the main characters die this season? I don't know. That could be interesting. That could be a way, you know, maybe like Mike or one of the main characters gets consumed by one of the that Lovecraftian monster.
Yeah, and maybe potentially they were going after something that's, you know, more for, you know, something like a treasure of some kind.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that – but you can read the whole trailer breakdown on the site. But one other thing I wanted to mention, like, there's stuff in this trailer breakdown that you will not notice. Like, in the scene where they're playing the game, Dustin is wearing this t-shirt with the periodic table of contents. And this is a clever reference by the Duffer Brothers, because they were kind of chastised online on Reddit and stuff for including a periodic table the periodic table in the school in season one, and there were elements on there that weren't introduced or discovered for the next decade. So now they have the correct table periodic table on his shirt. And I don't think that's a coincidence, but
yeah, it's like James Cameron fixing the skyline, like the starscape in Titanic, after Neil deGrasse Tyson called him out and said it was inaccurate.
It's just fun. Yeah. Hold on 1 second. And coming off of Comic-Con, there is a lot of loose ends and a lot of information that came out over the weekend that got missed, especially around Marvel. To talk about that, I have HT from the site. HT, how's it going?
Good, good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. You wrote a few articles on the site today about the basically the leftovers from the Marvel interviews that happened at Comic-Con. The first up I wanted to talk about is the one of the directors of Infinity War, Joe Russo, mm-hmm. basically yes. shed some light on what is going on, because at D23 they unveiled that Thanos is going to have a group of minions that will mm-hmm. help him hopefully achieve domination and get all the Infinity Stones. Joe Russo kind of explained what their role in this film is. What do we know?
So Thanos will be accompanied by his minions called the Black Order. They are from the comics, but they've been introduced more recently, as recently as 2013, in a run by Jonathan Hickman, Jerome Opina, and Jim Chung in New Avengers Volume 3. And they're kind of a new sort of goon for him. He's always been kind of a loner before, and like single-minded in his mission against to find the Infinity Gauntlet. But here, Joe Russo said they're meant to increase Thanos' menace and kind of help battle the sprawling amount of superheroes that exist in the MCU. And I guess they have different powers as well. So there is a right-hand man, Corvus Glaive, who tends to act as Thanos' messenger. There is Corvus' wife, Proxima Midnight, who acts as enforcer. The Black Dwarf, who is kind of a monster who is about the size of the Hulk. And Ebony Maw, who is a sorcerer who has battled Doctor Strange in the comics. And so they're there to definitely increase Thanos' intimidation.
Yeah, not only that, in the comics, they're not related to Thanos, but mm. now they're going to be his, I believe, adopted children, which makes this a bit more personal. Adopted children just like Gamora and, oh my God, what's her name?
Nebula.
Nebula, yes. Mm-hmm. They're making it more personal, and I think Joe said something about that too, that this is going to be a whole new Thanos. What did he say about that?
So this Thanos is adopting a more casual approach, is what Joe said, because we don't see him in his armor anymore that we first saw him in the after credit scenes of Avengers and even in Guardians of the Galaxy. Here he doesn't have his armor, he doesn't have his helmet, which is why he kind of looks a little bald. You're like, oh, I guess he didn't have hair in the end. But it's apparently a very philosophical, spiritual part of his journey. As he's collecting the Infinity Stones, he doesn't require the armor as much when he was a warlord, Joe Russo said, so to quote. I paraphrased it.
Well, that makes sense, and it probably will make for a, a more, you could see the character come out more when he's not under all this armor. Also, the Black Order, I guess, is probably like any, anybody that's watched a series of television like Buffy or, whatnot knows that, these minions are added so that the heroes can take down some people throughout the story.
Yeah. Yeah, and also the big bad needs someone to bounce off of. You can't just be there monologuing the entire time, too.
Oh, for sure. Also at Comic-Con, Kevin Feige was doing interviews. He didn't do an interview with us, but he did an interview with, I believe, IGN and MTV. He explained, well, Captain Marvel is going to be one of those movies that is after Infinity War. And we learned at Comic-Con that Captain Marvel is going to be a movie that takes place in the 1990s and co-starring Samuel Jackson as Nick Fury, a two-eyed Nick Fury. The other big reveal at Comic-Con was that the Skrulls are going to be in it. So what does that mean for the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
So the Skrulls we first got a glimpse of, or got a hint of, rather, in Guardians of the Galaxy. It was actually the Kree who we saw more of in Guardians. But one of the big parts...
They're kind of like the enemies of the Skrulls,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. Exactly. One of the big parts of the Marvel Comics mythology is the Kree-Skrull War, which has been waged over decades, I think, of just like comics issues. And I don't actually know much about the Skrulls. I think they are shapeshifters. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Yeah. And there's this whole huge, I think, event series, I think it was Secret Invasion, where they actually come in and like take over, you know, shapeshift into some of superheroes we know, and it becomes very confusing. And I'm sure now that we've done Civil War and we're doing Infinity War, Secret Invasion is probably coming down the line, especially since they're setting up the Skrulls.
Yeah, and now that we've established our characters, it'll be easier to do all the doppelgangers and backstabbing that the Skrulls will entail. So yeah, apparently the Kree-Skrull War, that mythology will factor into Captain Marvel, which will be interesting because it's set in the 90s, 20 years before Iron Man.
And Feige was also asked about the future of superhero movies. Yeah, he said something to Variety. What did he say?
Okay. So to quote, he said, and nobody would get fatigued more than all of us at Marvel Studios. We live this, we breathe this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So almost every film we make and every decision we make is to keep ourselves interested and to keep things fresh and to keep things unexpected. And so far, as you say, 19 films in, the audience seems to be responding to that. So he's saying that he does worry about superhero fatigue, and even he is feeling it himself, but he's trying to keep the genres and the movies as interesting and different as he can in Marvel Studios, at least. And I think they've been doing that. Like, they've been playing with genre with each film. We saw it with Spider-Man, with the John Hughes teen movie, with the heist film in Ant-Man.
Even Thor Ragnarok looks completely different from the other two Thor movies.
Yeah, it's really exciting. So, go ahead.
I'm sorry. If you thought the Avengers, you know, couldn't get together as a team previously, imagine the Skrulls, you know, infiltrating them, you know, and pretending, you know, and breaking that group up even further. I can imagine that might be the end of this upcoming phase after Infinity War. Or maybe this could even be Avengers 4. We don't know what Avengers 4 is. But
right. We thought it would be Infinity War Part 2, but it could be a completely different story.
For sure. Another story you wrote up on the site today is the Spider-Man Homecoming Art of book came out, and it has some revelations. And one of the revelations is that some other Avengers were originally going to be part of Spider-Man Homecoming alongside Iron Man. So what did we learn?
So there is a photo in the art book of concept art of the original script, and it included Vision and War Machine taking a role in the ferry scene in Spider-Man Homecoming. So in this scene, you see Vision lifting a car up from the water, and War Machine is helping Iron Man to repair the ship in its holes. And in the film, we see... this is one of Spider-Man's big kind of failures. He ends up saving the ship, but ripping it in half, and it ends up being Iron Man who has to repair it and, like, fix Peter's mess, essentially. So it does play a pivotal part in Peter's kind of reckoning, but I think it might have been too crowded if we had more than just Iron Man in there. I think it was already kind of cutting it a little close with having Iron Man play such a pivotal role in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Oh, for sure. And we don't know why those characters were removed, but I'm assuming it, you know, the, there was such a more personal connection between Tony Stark and Peter Parker and that mentor-mentee relationship and how Peter Parker kind of fails Tony Stark in this moment. I feel like it's more personal when it's just one, you know, it's just him. It's not, you know, the Avengers coming in to save the day.
Yeah.
So I think we both, what was that?
Oh, I was going to say, it would have been like another Avengers 3.5, like Civil War was. So just all the Avengers coming in, being disappointed for one scene and then leaving.
For sure. And that does it for today's edition of Slash Film Daily. I want to thank both Huaitran Bui and Ben Pearson for joining me. You can find both of their work on slashfilm.com. HT runs a podcast called The Millennial Falcon, which you can find on iTunes. If you like this show, please go to iTunes. Please give us a review, rate it, tell your friends. We're still going to be doing mailbag segments, so if you have a question, please send it to us at peter@slashfilm.com, and hopefully we'll get to it. There's just been so much news lately that we haven't had time, but we will be trying to do more of that, and we'll probably be trying to do some more feature segments in the future. Thanks for listening.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.